This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome a returning guest back to the show. That is Brian Beaulieu. He is CEO at ITR Economics and author of Prosperity in the Age of Decline, How to Lead Your Business and Preserve Your Wealth Through the Coming Business Cycles. Brian, welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Jason. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. There is a lot going on in the economy. There's a lot going on with the Fed and interest rate discussions. Where shall we start?
Let's start with looking into the future here a little bit. As you and I are talking, there's a lot of consternation about the economy softening up here in the waning months of 2019. Everybody seems to be getting caught up in that, and I think that's a mistake. What's really more important to look at is look out 6 months, a year beyond this. You have to be thinking a half business cycle ahead if you're going to get a competitive edge going for yourself. We're not caught up in the weakness because we saw that coming a year ago. What's important now is looking for the leading indicators that are telling us about the next rising trend. They're beginning to form already into reversals. We follow over a dozen leading indicators, and three of them already have turned up into statistically significant rising trends. So it's time to look at that next trend and be able to zero in on those opportunities that arise from the next trend, rather than worrying about, is the Fed going to lower interest rates another 25 bips? That's ancient history by now, and if you aren't positioned for it, you're not going to be. I'd rather you get positioned for the next global business cycle expansion where interest rates are going to be moving the other way.
Tell us about that next cycle, and then let's talk about how to position for it.
The next cycle is going to be the up phase of a new business cycle. We're concluding the current business cycle, and it's global, as most people are aware of, and we expect that the next rising trend will also be global. It's not going to be particularly strong, but it will be markedly better than what we've been going through for the last 6 months, and we're going to be going through for the next 6 months. This deceleration is going to turn around into acceleration. So we fully expect that in the second half of 2020, we'll be on the upside of another cycle that will carry us all the way through 2021. And that timing is what we're getting off some of the preliminary reversals from the leading indicator.
Sounds like you're pretty optimistic then about things.
You can call it optimism. We call it realism. I mean, things aren't good or bad, optimistic or pessimistic. We just read the trends and look at what's going on. And it's just realism is all it is. But yeah, you can call it upbeat if you want.
Yeah, it seems upbeat, which, you know, a lot of people are predicting, you know, that the cycle is ending and it's time for a recession. So we're hearing, you know, that kind of talk a lot. And that's why I mention it. Tell us about some of the indicators that you really value in terms of forecasting future trends.
Okay, it's not going to be as neat and bow-tied an answer as you may like, because some of our best leading indicators are proprietary to ITR Economics. We've developed them to be very, very good long-term leading indicators. By long-term, I mean 12 to 18 months visibility into the future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've created them, we've honed them, and they work exceedingly well for us. One of which we're showing a lot in our presentations is a retail sales leading indicator. It leads by 18 months. So there's no doubt in our minds that the retail sales sector is going to be seeing diminishing growth between now and the end of 2019 and probably the first quarter of 2020. That's pretty much fait accompli at this point. Mm-hmm. Look, the leading indicator is suggesting that retail sales are going to slow down to about a 2.8% growth rate at their trough, their slowest point. Now, that's enough to keep us out of recession, but it really puts us on the hairy edge of recession. It's enough that the Federal Reserve will probably have the latitude to lower interest rates one more time if they want to. I don't think that's going to rock anybody's boat one way or the other. The global marketplace has been advertising that is going to happen for quite some time. these leading indicators like the ITR retail sales leading indicator, the ITR financial leading indicator, and a few others are telling us interest rates, business activity, retail sales activity, wages, all are going to be in a brand new rising trend beginning in the second half of 2020. Mm-hmm. I think if your readers want one to follow that, or your listeners rather, I want one to follow that they may not be already tuned into, I suggest the G7 leading indicator. It's put out by the OECD in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
We run a rate of change on that. But that's an offbeat one for most people, and it's a good one. Another one that we find very useful and most people don't follow, and it's readily available, is copper prices. Copper is the metal with a PhD in economics, so use it. And it tells you what to expect.
That's interesting. And I do talk about copper a bit. That's a very interesting expression I've never heard. Copper is the metal with a PhD in economics. Tell us more about that. I love it.
Well, it's just such a ubiquitous commodity. And it just happens to be a bellwether commodity that when the pricing is going up, you know where industrial demand is heading. Barring some other extraneous event, and when it's going down, it tells you where industrial demand is going on the downside.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been, in the 35 years that I've been doing this, one of these cycle-in and cycle-out indicators that I can count on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting, good stuff. So, interestingly, there has been a lot of pressure from the Trump administration, or specifically Trump's Twitter account, to see some lower interest rates, even negative interest rates. What do you think about that?
I think that we've seen presidents in the past harangue Federal Reserves for lower interest rates. This is nothing new. I don't recall any president ever haranguing for negative interest rates. That's sort of extreme, but that's sort of par for the course.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly as you go into an election year, presidents like lower interest rates. They don't like higher interest rates. I think the Federal Reserve needs to be independent of the body politic, and I think Chairman Powell has been doing a good job stating that if required, they will lower interest rates. He's just following the marketplace lead and doing a pretty good job of tuning out the president. It's not beyond most people's understanding that lower interest rates also helps a real estate investor more than your average person out there. And our president is a real estate investor, so he needs those lower interest rates for two very good reasons.
Yeah, I like to say that Trump is our first real estate president, if you will.
Very interesting.
Well, what else do you want people to know? I know we've got to wrap this interview up kind of in short order, but maybe any things I haven't asked you about. I want to ask you about trade war and labor, too, before you go, but go ahead.
There are a real estate-centric point that we've been making with people is you look at the demographics of the United States, and you look at the historical occupancy rating, if you will, for home ownership. We're way below norms. We at ITR Economics think that the housing industry is going to be a very strong part of our economy through the end of the 2020s. That doesn't mean it won't have some ups and downs. Cycles are always going to happen, but the underlying trend, the secular trend, is going to be quite positive for the housing industry, both in terms of volume, in terms of builders, in terms of realtors, in terms of lumber yards. I mean, it's going to be a good part of our economy. We've taken a bit of a hit for various and sundry reasons, but it's catching its breath, and I think you're going to be enjoying the rise that's about to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very interesting. Very interesting perspective. So talk to us a little bit about trade, if you will, and, you know, this constant talk of the trade war. And I think the media has portrayed that really in a very lopsided fashion. You know, not talking about the good that comes out of it in terms of American jobs. You know, we've seen pay increases. Now, you're welcome to disagree with me, but you know, I think there are definitely some good benefits, but all you hear are the bad things, you know? It's a double-edged sword.
Well, Jason, there's no doubt that there are winners in any tariff or protectionist situation. But in terms of wage increases, they were going on before the tariffs were ever imposed. They just weren't getting a whole lot of press. In terms of jobs being created, we're actually seeing a slowdown in the rate of rise in jobs. This is one of the peculiarities of this whole trade issue. we impose tariffs at the top of a business cycle. Traditionally, you impose tariffs or other forms of protection to stimulate U.S. job, quote-unquote, creation, and to protect local industries, U.S. industries, because they can't compete on the global sphere. And that was initially the rationale. And what had me befuddled from the very beginning is, if we're trying to stimulate employment, where are we going to get the people? We don't have a supply of labor to satisfy the demand. The only reason we haven't seen more of a price increase in wages, which would hurt profitability, is businesses have been making Herculean efforts in the form of automation and really obviating the utility of labor in any of their business, or as many of their business processes as possible. Long run, and I'm a macroeconomist, Jason, long run, tariffs, protectionism, decreased competition. Decreased competition leads to inefficiencies. Inefficiencies leads to inflation, structural imbalances within the economy. And ultimately, somebody has to pay that price. And whether you're talking about the Jones Act and shipping in the United States and what that cost means, sure, we created more welding jobs, we created more machinist jobs, but somebody had to pay for those, and the consumer ended up paying big time for all of that. So there are winners and there are always losers, my friend.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is a very hard balance, but it just feels like most consumer prices, and I'm really referring to things that are imported from, of course, mainly China, are incredibly cheap. I just can't believe sometimes how inexpensive and what good quality we get to enjoy today. You know, it's the opposite of inflation. I mean, I remember in the 90s how much more everything costs than it does today. Everything today is so much better and so inexpensive. You know, I sort of wonder, do we really need prices this low? Now, that doesn't apply to everything. Food, college tuition, healthcare, completely overpriced. Assets, if you want to buy a house, very expensive. But consumer products are just cheap. You know, I think it might be better to have a high-paying job or a job at all, you know?
Well, in terms of the cheapness of consumer products, that increases the standard of living of the consumer.
Sure,
because
it does.
Now you can afford the phone, you can afford the TV,
right.
Multiple TVs.
Yeah.
The opposite is you decrease the standard of living of the consumer. So if you're going to start making things more expensive than their level of utility for all these consumer goods is going to be diminished, because you're not going to have as many of these consumer goods because you cannot afford them anymore.
Yeah.
Make no mistake about it, globalization, whether you and I like it or not, is under severe negative pressure. You look at Brexit, you look at Italy, Austria, China, Brazil, and the United States. Nationalism, my friend, is the new trend.
Yeah, right.
Not globalization. So be careful what you wish for, because nationalism is going to get you the future that you just espoused, and there will be winners and losers in that scenario too. There always are.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. It's just that we, until recently, haven't seen a real pay increase for Americans in decades.
Now, I can't agree with you there. I've got shows otherwise, Jason. Government data that shows, and whenever I do a talk, I just did one yesterday in Milwaukee, so I show them how in Wisconsin, real wages have indeed gone up. After adjusting for inflation, people are making more money today than they were 10 years ago, than they were 20 years ago. You know, the politicians love to throw out other numbers to prove
whatever point they want to make, yeah. Right.
And I just deal with the facts, man. I just look at the numbers. The numbers say real people making more money than ever before. This system of our form of capitalism isn't perfect, but gosh, it really works. And
it's pretty good.
Really
yeah.
well.
No question about it. Yeah. I'll agree with you there. By the way, what time period are you talking about? Because I have heard I've heard so many studies, I've read so many articles showing that like 1977 was sort of the mark, and up until just 2016, give or take, no real dollar pay increases. Now, of course, you got to segment that geographically by income. I get it. It's complicated, I know. But just tell us a little more about your numbers, and let's wrap it up with that.
I specified my time periods, 10 years and 20 years. Mm-hmm. Going back to 77 goes back to our prior generation. We had a lot more inflation then, so you're looking at some significantly inflated wages during that period. And there's been some really good studies that say you don't look just at wages. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have a chapter coming out in our next book about this. You have to look at the standard of living. And right. It goes back to your earlier point, Jason. We have more things available to us. We enjoy more aspects of all these things. We have more free time. Our standard of living is so much higher today than it was in 1977 or 1987, for that matter. I don't want to go back to those times whatsoever. I don't want America to go back to those times either.
Give out your website, Brian, and tell people where they can find your book, too.
You can find the book on the website, Prosperity in the Age of Decline, and the website is itreconomics.com, and you'll find us there.
Yeah, good stuff. One last question before you go. Just interesting, Prosperity in the Age of Decline. You sound very optimistic in this interview, and now I know you're, say, just realistic, but, you know, you said some very positive things. Is the decline something that's out further in the future, or is it a catchy title, or just explain that title a little bit, if you would?
Well, it's twofold. People think we are in some sort of age of decline now. America's losing its prowess. The Chinese are going to overtake us. We're not as good as we used to be. The system is broken. Capitalism isn't working. All that stuff is negativity that is out there. But so we're countering that. There's a lot of prosperity for those who want to take control of their own financial and economic future. There's no lack of prosperity. We are concerned about a future date that isn't in the next 8 years, further out than that, where our government's free spending ways, and my friend, I'm sure you've been looking at how fast the national debt has been increasing here in the United States. I'm sure you're aware of how fast China is just subsidizing their growth with a house of cards called debt.
Yeah.
The world is increasingly awash, and it primarily led by China and then the United States and then Japan. That can't go on forever. There are people out there that want you to think that it can go on forever, hence the new monetary theory, modern monetary theory.
MMT, right.
Which is, it's just a joke, but yeah, it's part of how we're going to rationalize our lack of fiscal responsibility. That gets you into a whole lot of trouble eventually.
Yeah, well, I agree with you about MMT. All right, Brian, thanks for joining us, and happy investing.
Thanks for having me on, Jason. I appreciate it. Look forward to the next time.
Always good talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.